PCJ Radio International presents the longest-running international show, The Happy Station Show, produced and presented by Keith Pehong.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to another edition of your program, Happy Station from PCJ Radio International, your Sunday program of everything and anything for anybody and anyone. Yes, Happy Station, the only program heard on Sundays here on PCJ Radio International. Nice to have you with us for this, the 10th of June, 2018. And we, of course, are now going into summer. So I do want to take a moment after our first piece of music today to tell you about something that we do every summer, which is our summer series. But first, let's begin with Frank Sinatra and Chelsea Holm. This is from the soundtrack to the movie High Society with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Wants to be a millionaire?
I don't.
Have flashy flunkies everywhere?
I don't.
Who wants the bother of a country estate?
A country estate is something I'd hate.
Who wants to wallow in champagne?
I don't.
Who wants a supersonic plane?
I don't.
Who wants a private landing field too?
I don't.
And I don't, cause all I want is you. Who wants to be a millionaire?
I do.
Who wants uranium to spare?
I don't.
Who wants to journey on a gigantic yacht?
Do I want a yacht? Oh, how I do not. Who wants a fancy foreign car?
I don't.
Who wants to tire of caviar?
Who wants a marble swimming pool too?
I don't.
And I don't, cause all I want is you. Who wants to be a millionaire?
I don't.
And go to every swell affair? Who wants to ride behind the liveried chauffeur?
Chauffeur, do I want?
No, sir.
Who wants an opera box, I'll bet?
I don't. And sleep through Wagner at the Met.
I don't. Who wants two corner Cartiers too?
I don't.
And I don't. Cause all I want is you.
Frank Sinatra and Chelsea Holm with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire from the original soundtrack recording to the movie High Society that also starred Frank Sinatra and Grace Kelly. Yes, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? I wonder if when they were thinking of the title of the television game show, if that's the song that they had thought of. I remember on one edition of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, they actually had a question about who wants to be a millionaire. I don't remember the question. All I remember is the person actually got it wrong. They got a little bit confused for some reason. But anyway, good movie. Anyway, nice to have you with us today. And we, of course, are now in the middle, almost in the middle of June. And every June and July and August, here at Happy Station, we like to present what we call our summer series, where we present a whole bunch of special programs for the summertime. Now, I should tell you that this year, of course, it's going to be slightly different. And the reason for that is this year, of course, is the 90th. Yes, the 90th anniversary of Happy Station. And as we have been doing since January, on the last Sunday of every month, we present another anniversary special. So this year's, this month's anniversary special is going to be on the 24th of June. So the last Sundays, of course, will be regular. I don't know if I can say regular Happy Station, but our anniversary programs and the rest of the time our summer special series, our series of special summer, or our summer of special series programs, if you get my meaning. Anyway, that's actually what we have coming up. We are still in the middle right now of actually deciding what we are going to do with that. So as of yet, we don't have a clear picture, but I will hopefully have that by next Sunday, next week's program. Actually, no, we are beginning today, aren't we? Yes, we are. I'm sorry about that. I was thinking something else. So let's have our first piece of our next piece of music. And then I'll tell you what our first program in our summer series is. Here's The Gimmicks and The Joker. Gimmicks from Sweden with The Joker here on Happy Station from PCJ Radio International. Now, before I said to you that our summer series will begin later, and actually, no, that actually is today, and there isn't a reason why I was kind of getting mixed up, because before recording this week's program, the one that you're listening to right now, actually, I was quite occupied because we were recording a number of programs that are going to be broadcast actually in August and September. And I actually couldn't remember which one we were doing. I think we just did Nod Up and Down in our control room. I think we just finished doing six, right? Yes, we just finished doing 6 hours of pre-recorded programs. And after you do it for a while, you don't know which is which and who's who and what's what anymore. But anyway, no, actually, we're beginning it today. Now, one of the things that we do during our summer series is we bring you interviews that a number of you actually had wanted to hear again. And we're going to do that right now with a special program that we recorded a few years ago with British pop singer Helen Shapiro. Now, Helen Shapiro in the 1960s had a number of hits, and she even toured with the Beatles and some other well-known acts. So here's our look back at Helen Shapiro.
Well, just because I'm in my teens and I still go to school, don't think that I dream childish dreams. I'm nobody's fool. Don't bother me. That makes me wild. And please don't treat me like a child. And not be heard, but I want you to realize that is quite absurd. Don't wanna be so meek and mild, so please don't treat me like a child.
I have so many things that I want to ask. I mean, you started in the music industry at a very young age. I believe you were 14 when you recorded your first single.
That's right, I was. It was called Don't Treat Me Like a Child, and frankly, it was a cry from the heart.
Now, let me ask you, because you started at 14, and you were recording at Columbia with people such as Nori Paramore, who at the time was recording with everybody from Cliff Richard, Frank Ifield, Adam Faith, and anybody else who was, you know, passing through the studio. What was that like? Because, I mean, Nori was much older than all of you at the time.
Yeah, that's true. He was like a father figure to us, actually. But in those days, that's how the situation was. Columbia Records in this country was one of the labels that came under the EMI banner, and Nori was one of several house producers, along with people like George Martin, mm-hmm. And so forth. Nori was a big name in his own right, actually, as a musician, as a conductor and arranger and a songwriter. So it was a great privilege, actually, to have him guiding my recording career.
You know, a friend of mine who also was on the same label, which you met many years ago, Frank Ifield, was telling me some funny stories, and he says he remembers the funniest one when he first showed up in the UK to record at Columbia. He said before they went to the studio, they were in an office, they were rehearsing the number that they were going to do. They walked to the studio, there was the full orchestra, there was some technicians in the control room wearing white lab coats, smoking cigarettes, looking like doctors more than anything. Nori walks in, went to the podium and say, okay, we're going to make a take. And then he said, off in the corner were these four women drinking tea, probably doing some crochet. They got up, they did the back vocals. As soon as the session was done, they sat back down, drinking tea, and continued with their crochet work.
Well, yeah, that's a pretty good picture of how it was in those days, I have to say. I think maybe the technicians might have discarded the white coats by the time I got into the studio in early 61. But it was like that, yeah. And you recorded live. The band was there in the studios. The singers were there. I think Frank would have been referring to the Mike Sams singers, who also sang on my records. And yeah, it was like that. You'd be sitting in the studio with a cup of tea, and you got up and sang, because everybody read music, and they had the music parts in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And you did a take, and if it didn't work, you started again, you did another take. And it was all done like on two tracks or four tracks, unlike the way it is today. Actually, when I look back and think of what we used to do, it's pretty scary, but we didn't know any different. But there was a good live sound, you know, to those early records.
What I found quite amazing was the fact that back then, because the musician unions, the singer had to perform live with the orchestra, and that if you wanted to do a voice take, you kind of had to do it in secret almost.
That's absolutely right. Whereas on the continent, because I did records in Germany and France, you were allowed to put the voice on afterwards. Frankly, though, I have to say it was much better singing live with the band. It had a feel to it,
mm-hmm.
which you could lose in those days. Because when I recorded in Germany and France, I put the voice on. They always had the voice right up the front, and they had the musicians sounding like they were 2 miles away. So it lost something, I think.
What was it like back then? I mean, you were working and traveling around the UK with people like Frank Ifield, Cliff Richard, and Adam Faith, and you were like the youngest one in the group. What was that like?
Well, my first year in the business, I was actually still at school. So I was very limited by law in what I could do. So I was allowed to just do the occasional radio program or TV show and do the odd concert in the school holidays and things like that. Once I left school at the end of 1961, having already had my first three hit records, it was a question of going on the road. A whole bunch of different performers piling into a coach and just traveling around the country, doing concerts in cinemas and in town halls and things like that. I loved it. I never actually went on the road with Cliff or Frank or Adam. By that time, it was my own show, and we had other different people on the show. And I loved every minute of it. It was such a thrill. I mean, because I was a kid, I was only 15 by the time I went out on the road. And one of the tours I did, we had the Beatles on the show. They were one of the opening acts.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like 21 years old. I was 16. That was in early 63. But I just enjoyed every minute of it. I couldn't wait for the next tour. We did one tour after another in those days. I loved it.
Do you look back at that now and say to yourself, I can't believe I did that?
Yeah, frankly. Yes, I mean, I couldn't do all of that I did then. I mean, obviously, when you're young, you have the energy, you have the excitement. You have a brashness and a confidence that gradually fades as you get older. Just as you, obviously, you gain experience and you realize the pitfalls. But when you're young, you can do anything. I'm glad I did it. I wouldn't like to do it again.
That's what Frank had told me on a number of occasions. He said, you know, back then, he said, I could do anything. But he said, now when I think about that, it just even thinking about it makes me tired.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with him entirely.
Well, here's something, because back then, of course, unlike today, the record company really had a lot of control over the songs that many of the singers were doing. And the John Lennon and Paul McCartney even wrote a song for you called Misery, but you didn't turn it down.
No, I didn't. It was turned down by Norrie Paramore on my behalf before I even knew that it existed. The first day that I met the Beatles when we were starting on the tour, they told me, we submitted a song that we'd written for you, which, because I was going to Nashville at that time to record an album. I think they may have thought it was for that. And they said Norrie turned it down. So it was a fait accompli. But never mind. Somebody else recorded it after that.
But the thing is, when this kind of thing would happen, I mean, not just with you, but with other singers, would all of you kind of gather around and say, you know, I wish that they hadn't turned it down, because I would have liked to have recorded it?
Well, I think at the time I thought that, but I didn't dwell on it too much. I was just having too much fun. At that time, I was, like I say, I was about to go to Nashville to do a record. I was doing all kinds of tours in other countries as well as in this country. I loved the Beatles. I enjoyed working with them, watching them on stage, and watching them grow and develop as a band. So it wasn't something that, you know, niggled me too much. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't even know if the song would have really suited me at that time.
Easy come, easy go. When you are young, then love is a tender glow. If it lasts for a day, enjoy it every minute, then let it go. Tomorrow you may find you are in love with someone new. Tonight you feel that only he can make your dreams come true. For it's easy come, easy go. While you're young, take what you can. For you may never find a love forever true. Yeah, easy come, easy go. When you are young, then love is a tender glow. If it lasts for a day, enjoy it every minute, then let it go. So make the most of kissing, for it's part of being young. And don't you be too downhearted if you find it's only fun, 'cause it's easy come, easy go. While you're young, take what you can, and don't make promises that never will come true. I said easy come, easy go. When you are young, then love is a tender glow. If it lasts for a day, enjoy it every minute, then let it go. I said easy come, yeah, easy go. I said easy come.
Now, you just mentioned that you went off to Nashville to record an album. Was that something that was obviously something that the record label had wanted to do, correct?
Well, yeah. They said, look, you can do an album in America. We'd like you to do that. You can choose New York or Nashville. And for some reason, I chose Nashville. I think I would choose New York now.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, Nashville was not because, I mean, I'm not into, well, I'm not a country music singer. But Nashville was, like, famous for Elvis Presley, the Everly Brothers, Brenda Lee, you know, and there was some good stuff coming out of there. So I said, let's do it in Nashville. And it was a fantastic experience. Again, it was totally different from doing a recording in this country, because in this country at EMI, even though you sang there with the band in the studio, you were sort of tucked away behind a sort of a glass, I don't know what to call it, like a cage. Whereas in Nashville, it was just in this big room, and I was standing there in the middle of the room, surrounded by musicians, and they were kind of making it up as they went along. It was just so wonderful, the atmosphere.
So it sounds a lot more relaxing than working at Abbey Road Studios.
It was, actually. It was great. I wish all my recordings could have been done that way. We were happy with the album. We released a couple of tracks from it when we came back, so it was a good thing.
So, I mean, when you started off at 14, it sounds like you were heavily influenced by, let's say, singers like Brenda Lee and also Alma Cogan. How much of listening to their music did that have an impact on you?
Well, I wasn't really influenced by Brenda Lee or Alma Cogan. My influences were Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan and Peggy Lee and people like that.
Mm-hmm.
I was brought up with jazz as my sort of basic first choice in music. So I listened, well, I didn't, as far as listening to any of this stuff, we didn't have a record player. We just listened to things as they came up on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother, he got into that kind of music before I did, and so he was a big influence on me for that.
Now, when you were first getting ready to record, because of your voice, I mean, it sounds more popular jazz and popular standards more than say rock and roll at the time. Did they ever think of maybe putting you in that direction?
Well, that was what I wanted to do. My ambition from a child was to be a jazz singer. I used to sing when I was a kid with my brother's jazz band at our youth club and that kind of thing. It wasn't anything they particularly... In fact, they were the ones who were pushing me into the pop side,
mm-hmm.
for which I was very grateful. I mean, I liked pop music and I liked all the pop singers of the day, but my ultimate thing was that I wanted to sing jazz and blues. In fact, I did an EP when I was, I think, still 15, called A Teenager Sings the Blues, and I would include things on that and on a couple of LPs, things like, you know, the real old-fashioned blues things like St. Louis Blues, Basin Street, Blues in the Night.
Mm-hmm.
And Norrie wrote a song called A Teenager Sings the Blues. So I was that was my influence coming in very early. And indeed, just before that, I think, we did an EP called Tiptoe Through the Tulips, which got into the singles charts, which contained Goody Goody, Birth of the Blues, Tiptoe Through the Tulips, which wasn't my choice, and another song which I can't remember.
But,
so it was always there.
But Tiptoe Through the Tulips, you didn't obviously sound like Tiny Tim.
No, thank the Lord. No, that came out much later. This was before that.
Right. You know? You know, there was also, you were also doing a lot of television work at that time on Ready, Steady, Go. And a few months ago, I'd interviewed a cameraman who used to work on that show when it was on from 63 to 66 on Ready Fusion. And yeah. I asked him for a funny anecdote, and he said he remembers one time, he said he doesn't remember who he was shooting singing. It was either Billy Fury or Adam Faith. But the director kept yelling in his headset saying, "There's something wrong with your camera." It kept going to black and then was being normal, and then it kept going to black. And the stage director and him realized that you were actually standing in front of the camera and your hairdo was getting in the way.
Me? Oh, wow.
And, you know, that, which leads me to the thing about, you know, the hair, because would you say that was a trademark of yours back then?
I didn't know it at the time, but, you know, looking back, yeah, because I get people coming up to me now, like women, who say, "Oh, I used to have the Helen Shapiro hairdo or hairstyle," and I didn't even know that it was a thing, you know, because to me, everyone had big hair in those days, and I wasn't a trendsetter. I never saw myself as that. I was just following what had gone before, but apparently it kind of stuck, which is fine. I'm happy with that.
How much work must have gone into that every time?
Oh, tons. You know, for me, getting ready each day, especially if I had a TV program or a concert to do, I'd be sitting there for an hour with the makeup and the hair and the whole thing. I mean, that's what we did in those days with the back combing and the hairspray and the whole thing. That was life. That was part of life.
What was it like working on Ready, Steady, Go? Because something that people who may have not seen the show was that everybody lip-synced to songs.
Oh, lip-syncing.
Yes.
Sorry. Yeah, we say miming. That's what we did in those days. I mean, actually, before Ready, Steady, Go, the big program was a thing called Thank Your Lucky Stars, which ran for many years, and the first TV I ever did was that. And you did. You mimed to your records. I mean, frankly, it made it a lot easier. But obviously, it was later on that people started doing live stuff. People just wanted the sound, because in those days, frankly, the TV studio sound systems and that weren't that great, and they couldn't reproduce the sound on the record. So it was just as easy for them for us to stand up and lip sync.
Well, I mean, doing Ready, Steady, Go, that must have been a blast, because it was at a time when the audience, when you know there was a live audience, but everybody was so close to the performers, it must have been so cramped, because you look, when I see the series now, that does not look like a big studio.
No, it wasn't, come to think of it. I think there was a sort of a balcony area where people could be upstairs and dancing and looking over, as well as what was on the floor. But, you know, we didn't know any different. For us, this was great, because, like, Thank You Lucky Stars, the other one before, was just in a bare studio with some rather strange-looking settings behind us. But it was great to be among the kids. You know, they loved it, and nobody caused any trouble, at least the ones I did. It gave a great atmosphere. You know, and this was in the days before Top of the Pops, which kind of, you know, took over from that. It was a good show.
So when you did Ready, Steady, Go, which was live, was there much rehearsing involved?
Yeah, I remember the one I did where I sang to the Beatles.
Look Who It Is.
Pardon?
You did the song Look Who It Is.
That's right. I think we ran it two or three times. The idea was I was just going to be going on and singing this song. And they said, "Listen, we've had this thought. Would you mind singing it to the Beatles?" I said, "Nah, it'd be great." And because there were only three kind of verses, there was a middle and then a middle section, they would only use three of the boys. So, you know, it took a while just to rehearse the camera shots, because there's me walking up and down there with them, and they wanted to make sure it was right. But frankly, probably much less rehearsal than they would take today. You know, today they'd be able to use computers and whatever else. But it was a fun time, that.
Do you enjoy working in television?
Yeah, I do. I've done very little television, I must say, compared to most other singers. For instance, you know, even though I had those records and all that going for me, I never had my own show, even a one-off, let alone a series. I often guested on people's shows, but not an enormous amount. But I do enjoy. I enjoyed television, particularly when there's an audience. But the thing that I enjoy and enjoyed most of all was just live concerts, live shows. That was always the best thing.
love me so. Your love is all I need. Whoops, gotta let the other dozen go. A dozen other boys kissed me before, but since your lips kissed mine, whoops, I've been begging you for more and more. A girl knows the boy she dreams of when her eyes first see him, and you're the boy I'm born to love. No one else could be him. A dozen other boys can't make one you. You do things to my heart, whoops, that the other dozen boys can't do. They just love me so. Whoops, gotta let the other dozen go. Kissed me before. Whoops, I've been begging you for more and more. A girl knows the boy she dreams of when her eyes first see him, and you're the boy I'm born to love. No one else could be him. Whoops, that the other dozen boys can't do. A dozen other boys. A dozen other boys. A dozen other boys.
Dozen. Yesterday I was watching a video of when This Is Your Life surprised you.
Oh, dear.
And you got out of the car, and you were going to be, you know, looked like you were going to record something else, and all of a sudden, This Is Your Life.
I tell you, I'll never forget it. I was quite traumatized by it. I mean, it was a great honor and everything, but I would never want to go through something like that again. I really thought, I had been told that I was going to be coming along to do take part in a tribute show to Humphrey Lyttelton.
Right.
Of Humphrey Lyttelton and his band, who I sang with for many years. And so I totally, totally did not know anything. People say, oh, you knew. I didn't know. And so getting out of that car, and there's Humphrey and his band playing Walking Back to Happiness outside the studios, and there's all these people standing around and cameras, and it still didn't click until Michael Aspel came round from nowhere with his book, and there was such a shock. I felt like I was being undressed in front of the whole world, you know. It was just, and they edited it. I actually couldn't speak for about 10-15 seconds, which for me is quite a feat.
After that, did you have a conversation with your husband saying, what did you do?
Well, kind of, sort of, yeah. I beat him up, actually. No, it was all him. He did all that. I mean, and he told me later all about it and how difficult it was to arrange and to keep it from me. But he did a great job. And it was lovely seeing everybody and going through it. But there was a kind of an unreal feeling about the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, I say it was an honor. And I'm very glad that they thought to do it for me. But had I had the choice beforehand, I would have said, no, please, no thanks.
Well, yeah. for the past couple of years, you've been heavily involved with gospel outreach.
Yeah.
How did that start?
Well, actually, I've been involved with my gospel evenings and outreaches since 1990. Well, in 1987, I made the most amazing discovery that Jesus was the Messiah promised to Israel. I'm Jewish, and that Jesus is the Messiah, after all, having read the messianic prophecies in the Old Testament and seeing their fulfillment in the New. And I made a commitment to him in 1987. And as a sort of an outworking of that, I began to put some songs together and do. They started off as concerts, just full concerts with the band and everything, in which I'd give my story. But I toned those down a little bit. They stopped being concerts, and just me standing up there telling about how I came to my faith,
mm-hmm.
And interspersed with some songs and giving the gospel message. And basically in various different forms, that's how it's been right up to this day. I would intersperse these evenings in and out, you know, in between my actual pop and jazz concerts, which I was doing many of. But I actually came out of the music business at the end of 2002 to concentrate full time on my gospel outreach evenings. And I love them, and I'm very busy doing those to this very day.
With the gospel outreach evenings that you do,
yeah.
Do people go to your show and sometimes ask you to sing some of your old hits?
Now, sometimes people say, oh, I thought you might have sung some of your old hits. In fact, I do sing Walking Back to Happiness mm-hmm. on that. I mean, what happens is, at the very beginning, a colleague of mine who plays guitar, we get up and we sing a few songs, and we get the audience joining in. These are spiritual songs, you know, biblical things, usually with a Hebraic feel to them, mm-hmm. Because that's the kind of music I tend to do. And then interspersed, like I say, within the talk that I give, are some other songs which I sing with backing tracks, songs that I've recorded in my gospel albums. But like I say, I do sing Walking Back to Happiness, and we're very, very clear to emphasize the fact that this is not a concert. That, you know, this is on the posters and on the leaflets and the advertising. This is a gospel outreach, so that anybody who comes knows they're not in for a concert. And then, you know, when I finish my bit on the platform, I then spend time talking to people. They come and talk to me for an hour, even 2 hours afterwards, and I love that.
How do you choose songs for the gospel outreach?
Well, there are only actually 5 songs that I sing with the backing tracks, and say another 5 with my colleague. That's a good question. I don't know how to answer it, really. It just kind of developed over the years. They tend to be, I suppose, they tend to be in keeping with what I'm speaking about. And so that's really how it's been down through the years.
Enter into his courts with praise. Enter into his gates with thanksgiving. Enter into his courts with praise. Rejoice and be glad in thy Creator. Rejoice and be glad in the Father of lights. Rejoice and be glad in thy salvation. Rejoice and be glad in the Ancient of Father of lights, rejoice to be glad in thy salvation, rejoice to be glad in the Ancient of Days.
the Father of lights, rejoice and be glad in thy salvation. Rejoice and be glad in the Ancient of Days. Rejoice and be glad in thy Creator. Rejoice and be glad in the Father.
And there we had it, our first program in our series of our summer specials, an interview that we did a few years back with Helen Shapiro, who had a number of hits in the 1960s. Yeah, anyway, what do we have for next week? I don't know anymore. I really don't know anymore. It's a long day. Yes, a long day. 7 hours in the studio recording six programs back to back. I think we recorded programs for when? October. Yeah, October and September. These are special programs for weeks that we are away, and we wanted to take the opportunity and get it done now so we don't have to do it then. Anyway, if you want to get in touch with us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address, pcjmedia@gmail.com. That's pcjmedia@gmail.com. And you can also find us, of course, on Facebook. Just do a search for PCJ Radio International. And, of course, you can add yours truly if you find me on Facebook. Keith, K-E-I-T-H, family name P-E-R-R-O-N. And if you're not strange, perhaps I'll add you. I'm just joking, of course. Everybody's a little strange. I like strange people. You like what you are, right? Okay. We're going to end today with Italian singer Gianna Nannini with a song called I Macchi. So, until next time, friends, I'm Keith Palmo wishing you well, saying so long, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, adios amigos, and sayonara.
Carezza della notte, quasi amor. sa che cosa avrai di più quando fa sera. Il cuore si scatena, mi va sulle scale, poi te lo darò quello che sento. Parlami ancora un po'. I maschi disegnati sui metro confondono le linee, ti miro nelle vetrine dietro ai bistrò. Ogni carezza della notte quasi dream.